I'd miss the game, so I kept it to myself. I wouldn't have jeopardized the team, but I knew that if I was in any way fit, with my experience, I could stroll through the game. I didn't eat much on Friday, and I ate nothing on the day of the game. But I remember thinking, it's Millwall. If I'm 10% right, I should be able to get through it. But I felt awful. About 10 minutes before kick-off, after the warm-up, still feeling weak, I threw my guts up in the dressing room toilet. I felt great after that. I drank a load of energy drink, would have been Lucozade or Red Bull, and got through the game quite easily. We dominated possession, so I didn't have to use too much energy. One of Ferguson's great strengths was that he always had a feel for the group when it came to team talks. He knew what would be needed. He'd spoken to us all week, building Millwall up. That was common sense. But in the hotel on the morning of the final, he spoke about the United players, us, where we were from, the different nationalities. He made different points about each of us. I remember thinking, brilliant. It was just what we needed. A feeling of pride. We were all together. There was no real logic to it, but it felt right. I've given team talks myself since, and I've often thought, I don't know where that came from, but it felt right. And I thought that morning in Cardiff that there was that pride. We were all playing in the cup final. I'm from Mayfield, and I'm playing with Ruud van Nistelrooy and all these other lads, Ronaldo from Portugal. It's amazing that we're all together. It wasn't about Millwall, and it almost had nothing to do with the cup final. It was about us as a team. Ferguson always got a spot on. We didn't need a tactical talk that day. Watch their fullback, watch their centre half, watch Dennis Wise. He'd be grabbing your balls or pinching you. None of that nonsense. Our attitude was, in a nice way, fuck Millwall, we're Man United, we'll do what's right for us. We're all in this together. We're all from different countries. It's brilliant. Our families are here. We're going to win this game. It was the only time I played in a cup final that I knew we were going to win. It was confidence, not arrogance. We had better players and our attitude was right. All week, the press had been full of FA Cup shocks. Southampton against United in 1976. Sunderland beating Leeds in 73. But I knew it wouldn't happen to us. Our group was too strong. We won 3-0. We wore replicas of Jimmy Davis's top. Davis and his squad number, 36, when we were going up to collect a trophy and our medals. I'd suggested. Jimmy was a good young player. He was out on loan to Watford. He drove into the back of a parked up truck at about 5 in the morning. The team went to the funeral. It had been very, very sad. So we finished the season with the FA Cup. Arsenal won the Premiership, and they haven't won it since. They started to lose some of their strong characters, and quite a few of them were irreplaceable. Character is just as important as skill. 3. The Highbury Tunnel was a strange one, like a little alleyway, very tight. It was hard to avoid contact with people, even if you were trying to. The rivalry between ourselves and Arsenal brought energy and passion. It was brilliant. I hated them. There was an element of jealousy there too, because I knew they were a bloody good team. But ultimately, they made me a better player. I had to be at my best. Petit and Vieira in the middle of the park. I couldn't have an off day against them. When we lost games to Arsenal, I was the first man to shake their hands. Chelsea were bringing a new challenge, but Arsenal, it was electric. And the crowd, their all-ground Highbury was an old-fashioned stadium. People said that it was a tight pitch, but apparently it was the same size as most other pitches. But we seemed to have less time on the ball, and their fans were almost literally on top of us. It made for a great atmosphere. We've not seen the like since, that bitter rivalry. There isn't as much physical contact in the game now. Clubs are buying a different kind of player. Technically gifted, but not fighters. But maybe it was just the timing. It wasn't just myself and Patrick. There were so many rivalries all over the pitch. I see players in the tunnel today hugging one another before a game. I don't think any of the United lads would have disagreed with me. They hated Arsenal. And the Arsenal lads hated United. Which of us was the better team? We couldn't call it. We were like two heavyweights battering each other. Patrick was the new kid. He's 5 or 6 years younger than me. Not that he looks it. He was a physical player. He was an important player for them, and I was important to United. There were always going to be fireworks, the way we both played. It was never going to be friendly. That would have been impossible. It wasn't as if we were both right backs, and we'd never come into contact with each other. We were in the centre of the park, and we were hitting each other at pace. That was going to lead to confrontation. It could be pointed out that I had a short temper, but the way we played, it had nothing to do with temper. We were both trying to control the pitch and the game. We were leaders. And if a leader is given to heated confrontation, other players will respond. It's normal. Patrick is 6'4". A big 6'4". He's a big guy. But I always tried to look at his height as a disadvantage for him. When it came to getting little breaking balls, I was sharp. I could read the game a little bit better than him. My anticipation and touch were a bit better, I think. But in a run for the ball, he was quicker than me. He should have had the advantage of me for headers, but I had a good spring in me. I'd had my running battles with Arsenal before Vieira arrived, right back to my days at Forest. I'd have had run-ins with Ray Parlour and Martin Keown. There was Paul Davis, John Jensen, David Rocastle. None of them were choir boys. We lost our first game of the new season 1-0 to Chelsea at Stamford Bridge. You always want to get a few wins under your belt, to build a bit of momentum early doors. But now, straight away, we were playing catch-up. I played centre-half that day, which also indicates a bad start to the season. If it had been February or March, fair enough, the squad would have been stretched. But playing out of position on the first day of the season, it wasn't a good sign. It's something about a lack of strength and depth. It was Mourinho's first game in English football. I remember the goal and the importance of it. A win against us, Mourinho was already the special one. It gave them that bit of early momentum and confidence. Remember, they'd finished second the previous season before Mourinho arrived. For the goal, I think I could have done better. When Gudjonsson went to finish it, could I have taken his head off? Maybe. Chelsea were stronger that day, but we were unlucky. The game reflected the season ahead. We were nearly there. We weren't bad. But we were always behind. Chelsea had spent a fortune. They had Carvalho and Drogba and Makélélé, and we'd slip behind them. But we always put up a fight. They only beat us 1-0. But that can tell a lot. They were solid. They were going to be hard to break down. But there was also the feeling that Mourinho wouldn't be staying around for long. I didn't think he'd be another Ferguson or Wenger. He wasn't going to be building a dynasty. Chelsea were very strong. But I also knew that Rooney and Ronaldo would be getting even better over the next year or two. There was no sense of panic. I always thought we'd bounce back. We'd get one or two more players in. And young players had been coming up through the academy. Darren Fletcher, John O'Shea, Wes Brown. We were in a transitional period. As a senior player, I was aware of that. It wasn't that the manager was saying anything like that to us, or to me. He wasn't. But I'd been at United for more than a decade, and I realised that things were in transition. Let's hang on in there and see what happens. But the changes couldn't take too long. There was always that demand to win trophies. We weren't in the dressing room going, "Don't worry, lads, we're in transition, let's lose to Fulham." There was always an urgency. Fans don't want to wait till next year. And we were still a good team. Fans always get a lift when a big signing comes. And so do the players. When Wayne Rooney walks into the dressing room, it lifts everybody. He arrived for the start of the 04-05 season. He was a top, top player immediately. I knew that from the first training sessions. And we played against him. His ability was easy to spot. I probably didn't warm to him as much as I had to Ronaldo. Wayne was a bit more streetwise. He was a scouser. All right, lads. He was straight in with the crack. Ronaldo was a bit more innocent. He acted like a 17-year-old, while Wayne seemed older. The only time I had a disagreement with Wayne, it had nothing to do with a pass he should have given me, or a tactical switch. We were in a hotel, the Friday night before a game. I forget where. The team would always sit down and have a meal together, at about 7 in the evening. There was a big TV in the room. I was into rugby league, and there was a big game on. I went to the toilet, came back, and someone had changed the channel to something else, something stupid, I can't remember what it was. A few of the players were sitting there, giggling away. I said, "Where's the rugby league?" I knew Wayne was up to something. I could tell by his face. I said, "Where's the remote control?" He said, "I don't know." I said, "You fucking do." I didn't exactly storm out, but I couldn't be bothered trying to get the remote control back. So I decided I'd watch the rest of the game up in my room. I came down the next morning for the pre-match meal, and obviously, I'm very good at letting things go, and Wayne was brave enough to come up to me. "Did you ever find the remote control, Rye?" I think I told him to go and fuck himself. It was the only disagreement I ever had with him. I think he later claimed in one of his books, he has a deal to write 10, that I sent a security man to his room to get the remote control, but that's bullshit. Alan Smith came in from Leeds and started really well. I'd all well with Smudge. One thing that struck me about him was that he never drank. That made him stand out a bit. He'd still have a late night with us, and a crack and a laugh. He'd stayed at a bitter end. I'd stopped drinking by this time, so we'd often end up chatting together. We were the only two left capable of holding a conversation. He moved from being a striker to playing in midfield. I think he was struggling to get a starting position as a striker. The manager might have been looking at him as an eventual replacement for me, but I never felt my place was under threat from him. I remember playing against him in a few practice games and thinking, yeah, he has a chance. But he never quite kicked on. It wasn't that he didn't reach his potential. He just didn't get the breaks. Or the breaks he got, injuries, were the ones you'd never want. Gabriel Heinze was another good guy. He was a nasty fucker. Nasty in training. I picked up an injury one day. A lot of it was my own fault. It was a Friday. We were playing Spurs at home the next day, and we'd always have light training the day before a home game. But it got a bit nasty, and it ended up with myself and Gabby having a few tackles on each other. He kneed me on the side of my leg, and being the hero that I am, I kept my mouth shut. I didn't want to go in for treatment, but I was in agony. I left the house the next day limping. I said to my wife, "Well, I won't be able to play. I'll just go in and tell them." I got to Old Trafford and limped, literally, to the dressing room. I got a few painkillers and played. My wife said it was the funniest thing, hearing my name being announced on the radio, after she'd seen me limping out of the house that morning. But I liked Heinze. He picked up a bad injury too later, his cruciate. A lot of the lads who came into the club at that time, Smudge, Gabby, Louis Saha, they were all very unlucky with injuries. The dressing room was changing. Younger players create energy. They can be raw. They're not fearful. An older player losing in a semi-final is devastated. A younger player thinks he'll be getting to finals for the next 30 or 40 years. They bring that arrogance into the dressing room. I became jealous of that as I got older. The longer you've been around, the less chance there is of winning something. The less chance that your contract will be renewed. The more chance there is of being injured. The young lads don't have those hang-ups yet. More players arrived. Gerard Piquet was a good lad and a good player, but he wasn't getting a run of games and he wanted to go back to Barcelona. We'd done all right there. I don't think anyone could have predicted just how much he'd achieve. This theory that he isn't a good defender,
He's one of the best.
He knows how to defend. Giuseppe Rossi was a really good lad, but he had a difficult time at United. He was an attacking player, and he had difficulty getting into the starting 11. Giuseppe is Italian-American, and one of the first times he trained with the first team, I gave him a bollocking. I think because he didn't pass the ball to me when I was in a better position. And he looked at me. He said nothing. But I knew what he was thinking. Why don't you fuck off? I turned away and I thought, I like that. If he'd said anything, I'd have run at him. But he looked right through me and the message was clear in his face. I nearly went over and shook his hand. I liked him from day one. I tried to sign him when I was managing Sunderland, and not succeeding is one of my big regrets. I was doing my pro license when we eventually got permission from United to speak to Giuseppe. I had a lecture that evening and I asked for permission to go to Altrincham in Manchester. I'd made arrangements to meet Giuseppe. I met him at an Italian restaurant. He turned up with about 8 agents. 3 of them were Italian. His dad turned up too. It was like a scene from Goodfellas. And I mean that in a nice way. I was at the head of the table, trying to persuade Giuseppe to sign for us. They were going, sell us Sunderland. And I gave him a line. It was either going to be very cheesy or he'd love it. We'd just been promoted. We'd agreed to pay 8 or 8.5 million for him, which was a lot for a lad who hadn't done too much yet. I said, look, Giuseppe, I've got a good orchestra up at Sunderland, but I need a conductor, and you're the man. They were all whispering, talking among themselves. I was thinking, it's either gone down really well, or he's not coming. We finished the meeting. I was really delighted with it. He goes, I've got to look at my other options. A few days later, he signed for Villarreal. He contacted me and said, right, thanks for everything. Villarreal or Sunderland? I understood his decision. Villarreal were making noises now, and as Diego Forlan had told me before, it was 20 minutes from the beach. We drew 3 of our first 5 games, and they weren't good draws. Blackburn, Everton, Bolton. We beat Liverpool and Tottenham, then 2 more draws against Middlesbrough and Birmingham. The signs weren't great. It wasn't league-winning form. They can always have a sluggish start, but we weren't used to draws. A draw against Chelsea would have been okay, but there were too many. It's all about winning. We beat Arsenal at home 2-0 and ended their unbeaten run of 49 games. I wasn't playing. That summer I'd gone to a detox clinic in Milan with Ryan Giggs and a couple of his mates. I think David Bellion might have been with us too. It was recommended to us by some of the French players. Their regime was strict. You starved yourself for 3 or 4 days and they educated you about diet. I was going through my health freakish phase at the time. Giggsy had been there before, and he'd warned me that we wouldn't eat. I didn't believe him. I thought we'd have to eat something. But I'd paid out quite a lot of money so I could fucking starve for 4 days. I never ate. Nothing. The first night, I wanted to leave, but I stayed. I think it was the 2nd or 3rd night when they gave us some carrot juice. The dietitian decided that I was eating too much red meat and I needed to cut back. I needed to eat more fruit and vegetables. I came home and went on the new diet. I wouldn't be mixing carbohydrates and protein. Typical me, the man of extremes, I went too far. I stopped eating red meat. I was almost divorced because I wouldn't eat what everyone else in the house was eating. I only eat the healthy stuff, and I stopped eating treats. My wife would be cooking for 5 kids, and I'd be going, I need to have fish and salad. As I said, I'm not a lover of fish, so I was trying to eat food I didn't particularly like. There was even one time my wife gave me a little trifle, and I asked her to take the cream off the top. My body fat went down to 3 or 4%. I went too skinny. A couple of days before we played Arsenal, I couldn't get out of bed. And I've never been one for being ill, never. Mike Stone, the club doctor, came to my house. I just couldn't get out of bed. No strength, no nothing. I knew I wouldn't be right for the game. And I must have been pretty bad to miss any game, let alone the Arsenal game. Mike asked me what I'd been doing over the last few months, and I told him about my detox in Milan. The decision to go there had been independent of the club in the summer. Mike wouldn't have been aware of it. He asked me, "What have you been doing with your diet?" And I told him, "Well, the woman told me to cut back on red meat." And he said, "And what have you done?" And I said, "Well, I've cut it out altogether." He did some blood tests, and I missed the Arsenal game. I was in bed for 3 or 4 days when the test results came back. My iron levels were gone. I'd no iron in my system. Mike told me I'd have to get back to eating red meat and eating things that I enjoyed. I think I was trying to eat and live like an Italian or a French player. But I'm Irish. My mother came over a week or two later and she had a right go at me, as only mothers can do. Any pictures of me then? I looked gaunt. I was cold all the time. I just wasn't myself. I'd gone too far. I had the body fat of a long-distance runner. But I was a midfielder, playing in tough games where you need protection. I was gutted that I'd missed the game, and all the fighting that went on in the tunnel afterwards. I couldn't even go to the game. There was pizza being flung around in the tunnel, but I wouldn't have eaten it. It wasn't healthy enough for me. I was well enough to go on as sub in the next league game against Portsmouth at Fratton Park. Phil Neville had played in my position while I was out. I remember the manager told me, "Listen, I'm putting you on the bench. Phil's done well for me the last few games." I said, "I think I've done okay in the 400 and odd games I've played." I could see his point of view. I wasn't denied. But I sat on the bench while we lost 2-0 and I thought I should have been playing. But I wasn't kicking up a fuss. I accepted the manager's view. But United were a better team with me in it. You have to think that way. In late October, we were 7th in the table. That's a sacking offence these days. Missing the Arsenal game because of my diet was unusual, but I'd always accepted injuries as part of the game. You expect midfielders to get injured. I'd had 2 hernia operations, hamstring injuries, maybe for not stretching properly in my younger years. I'd had broken ribs, stitches in the head, what I would class as normal midfielder's injuries. And, of course, the cruciate. Being out of the game for so long, 8 or 9 months, gave me a chance to grow up a little bit. Because I was drinking quite heavily at the time. I was 26 or 27, even a touch younger. The injury that would eventually stop me from carrying on was my hip. I'd been in Dublin the night before. This was in 2001, I think, doing a gig for Diadora. I'd had a really late night, drinking, a right session. I was training back in Manchester the next day, doing a little bit, going on a jog, and feeling something in my hip. It didn't feel like a massive tear, but it did feel a bit strange. I carried on playing for months afterwards, but eventually it took its toll. I saw a specialist, Richard Villar in Cambridge. Because it was the hip area, it was almost as unknown as a football injury. The standard injuries are hernias, broken legs, knees, ankles, even cruciates. But the hip was a worrying one. An, "oh, you don't want to go on there" type of operation. It was a bit taboo. You associate hip problems with older people. But the pain was unnatural. I was needing a lot of painkillers to get me through matches. It was probably wear and tear. All the twisting and turning. The way I played the game, quite physically. But all that drink in Dublin the night before hadn't helped. Maybe my running pattern was different that morning, and I hadn't slept much, or properly, the night before. Eventually, I had the operation. There was a flap of cartilage that had to be shaved off. I remember the surgeon told me that he wasn't sure if I'd be able to play again because of the cartilage damage. The way he described it to me, he said that when he put the scalpel under the cartilage, it was coming away like carpet underlay. He showed me the photographs too, and it did look like underlay. I recovered, came back, but I was still in a bit of pain. I knew I wasn't right. When you come back from a bad injury, you know, in medical terms, that the injury is healed. But you still have to deal with the battles in your head. The surgeon had planted a few seeds. There's a lot of damage in there, a lot of cartilage damage, and you want to be careful. I was due to have more surgery on it a few years later, but I changed my mind. I just decided, nah, I'll try and get on with it the way it is. Funnily, I think being stiff suited me. I had tight hamstrings. It was just the way I was. That feeling suited my personality. I don't think I was meant to be too flexible. I'd see some of the foreign lads doing stretches, touching their toes. Mikhail Silvestri could put his head on his toe. I'd injure my hamstring just looking at him. I could never touch my toes. I started doing a bit of yoga towards the end, but I think that kind of made me lose. I persuaded myself that I was more flexible. I'd known my limitations, but now I thought I was a gymnast. As with the food, I was trying to be somebody I wasn't, and I still ended up getting injuries. The hip was affecting the quality of my day-to-day life. Simple things like picking up my kids or getting out of the car. When I came back after my cruciate injury, people would ask, "How's your knee, the cruciate?" But I'd stopped thinking about it. The hip was the only injury that had and has long-term consequences. If the weather's cold or I kick a ball with my son and it's sore, or if I'm in the wrong driving position or on a plane, I'll be stiff. Chances are I'll need a hip replacement, but if I look after myself, I can avoid it for a long time. Any exercise I do has to be straight. Swimming, cycling, walking, no twisting and turning. We had 4 wins in a row. Newcastle, Charlton, West Brom and Southampton. You still have to go out and win them. But these were games that we would have expected to win. Although I always had a bit of hassle against Newcastle. I'd been sent off twice up there. I'd had my battles with Shearer and Rob Lee. I always thought they were an arrogant bunch for a club that had won fuck all. We always got decent results at St James's Park. It wasn't a bad place to play. But as for the Toon Army, the Geordies, the hostile reception, I never fell for all that crap. We drew with Fulham, away, but then we had another run of 4 wins in December and over the holiday period. We beat Crystal Palace, Bolton, Villa and Middlesbrough. We were 3rd in the table on New Year's Day, behind Chelsea and Arsenal. I'd met Brian Kerr, the new Ireland manager, just after he took the job in 2003. We talked about the possibility of me playing for Ireland again. There were 6 Euro qualifying games left. I'd eventually decided against because I felt I had enough on my plate trying to get back to full fitness. This was just after my hip operation. Sometime later, I met Brian again at the Alderley Edge Hotel in Manchester. I'd been doing some promotional work for the Irish Guide Dogs and I'd mentioned in an interview that I felt there was unfinished business. I was feeling fitter and stronger by now. I think the suggestion for the meeting came through my solicitor, Michael Kennedy. We discussed me going back for the 2006 World Cup qualifiers. I knew I'd be under massive pressure from United not to do it. I was at an age where the manager would have thought my priority should have been Manchester United, particularly with my history of injury problems. Also, going back to play for Ireland, the added games, and after all that had happened after Saipan, all the hassle and negativity, it would be putting a lot of extra pressure on me. United were paying my wages. I could see their point of view. The decision was straightforward, but emotional. I did feel that there was unfinished business. I was thinking about my family. I'm proud of being Irish and being from Cork. I think that feeling has got stronger as I've matured. I think when you go and live in a different country, even though England is only across the road, you can lose a sense of where you're from. It's natural. You adapt and integrate. You change your ways and ideas. My kids were born and reared in England. They often tease me about how they support England. But as you get older, there's a point. Maybe a feeling where you go, don't forget what it's all about. Don't forget where you come from. I didn't want to let the family down. But if I'd looked at it coldly, I wouldn't have gone back. It was my age. I was 33. Physically and mentally, it would have been another burden. I'd be playing in the middle of the park. The demands would be huge. People would expect miracles. And I knew there'd be consequences at United. I knew there'd be a price to pay. The manager wouldn't talk to me, but they couldn't stop me. There were no problems when I went back into the squad. They didn't bat an eyelid. I'd had no disagreement with any of the players. I liked Brian, and the only thing I found a little bit strange was that I wasn't the captain. I'd been captain before, and we'd had success. We got to the World Cup finals in Japan and Korea, and of course, I was the captain at United. But Kenny Cunningham was the captain. I played with Kenny over the years. He was popular with the players. He'd always be organising card schools and quizzes and whip rounds for the bus driver and for the women who'd served us tea in 1952. But most of the lads liked him. I'd always been a bit blasé about the captain's role. I'd often said that it was only about going up for the toss. I think I didn't want to talk the job, or myself, up. Oh, the captain's role is vital, look at me. But as I got older, I realised that there was more to it than that. The captain's role isn't just important. It is vital. And it isn't just an English tradition. Look at the great captains in Italy and Spain. Maldini, Dinozoff, Zanetti, Raul, Puyol. They're inspiring leaders. When, say, the Barcelona captain has to leave the pitch before the end of the game, he puts his armband on the player who has taken the job for the rest of the game. During the last World Cup, the Dutch captain, Van Persie, put the armband on Arjen Robben's arm when he was being substituted. Brian Robson, Steve Bruce, Cantona, great captains I played with. They led in different ways. Robbo led by example, in the way he was physically demanding and in his attitude to training. He was also a really good guy, and liked to drink. Brucey was very friendly and grey with the families. He always had a nice way about him, always had time for you. He was good with tickets, if you needed a few extra for family or friends. It was almost a political role. Brucey dealt with it very well, and he's brought that into his management. Cantona led by his presence more than anything else, his charisma. A captain doesn't have to be loud. Eric rarely said a word. In my early years at United, there was a players' pool, and each of us would get about 800 quid out of it at the end of the season for the work we'd done for the in-house magazines, the club videos. It was before all these things were built into the players' contracts. We were all on decent money, and 800 quid wasn't going to make or break us. So one time, we were in the dressing room, we decided to put all the checks into a hat. And the last check out, whoever's name was on it, he got to keep all the checks. To save face, we all put our checks in, except a couple of the younger players, I think it was Bex and Gary and Phil. They opted out. They were new on the scene and didn't have the money to spare. But Scolzi and Nicky Butt put their checks in. Last name out wins all the money. Great crack in the dressing room. Lads sweating, and I was fucking sweating. I used to think of that sort of money in terms of the amount of pints it would buy me. I think I was the third last name out, so I got a run for my money. But the last check out, Eric Cantona. He'd won about 16 grand. He came in the next day. There was plenty of banter. Eric, you lucky bastard. Fucking money to money. He got somebody at the club to cash the checks. He'd split the money in two. And he gave it to Paul Scholes and Nicky Butt, because, he said, the two of them had had the balls to go into it when they really couldn't afford it. The two lads took home about 8 grand each, which upset me even more. But I thought, what a gesture. Nobody else would have done it. Stuart Pearce was captain when I was at Forest. A brilliant, brilliant captain. I loved the way he played and trained. and he was the captain of England at the time. I've been lucky when it comes to people leading by example. Stuart defended me a couple of times. There was once I was having issues with my contractor first, and I was getting a lot of criticism. Brian Clough had said that I was being greedy. He was trying to put pressure on me through the media, trying to get me to sign a new contract. There were comments from some of the players in the dressing room, and it wasn't banter. I remember Piercy saying, "Listen, lads, are you all happy with your deals?" And they all went, "Yeah." And he went, "Well, fucking leave him alone." When I became captain of United, I knew if I made a balls of it, I'd have no one to blame but myself. I'd learned from Cantona, Stuart Pearce, Robbo, Brucey. I found the off-the-field responsibilities, tickets, the cresses for the kids, paying for Christmas dues, a pain in the arse. But it had to be done, and people expected you to do it. I organised a Santa Claus one Christmas, and I noticed, when it was too late and the pictures were being taken, that Santa had tattoos on his knuckles. It wasn't one of my better moves. The captaincy is important, but squad numbers can have an importance too. At United, 7 was the iconic number. When Eric Cantona left, there was debate about who was going to be the next captain. I was quite relaxed about it. But there was his number too. 7. Brian Robson had had it before Cantona, and of course, it went back to Georgie Best. The manager pulled me into his office and said he wanted me to wear the 7. I said, "No, I'm not bothered." And he said, "I know Bex will fucking want it, and I don't want him to have it." The little power battles. I'd had 16 since I'd signed for the club. I was comfortable with 16. I think it might have kept me on my toes, being outside the 1 to 11. I didn't think I was a number 7. I said, "Give it to Bex." Bex got it, and it suited him, and Cantona. Ronaldo had it after Bex. The captaincy of a great club is almost a brand within the brand. After I stopped playing football, I often noticed that people abroad were more impressed with the fact that I'd been the captain of United than the fact I'd played for them for nearly 13 years. The captain is the leader. I think you need someone at the front, at the top of the tunnel, who will inspire the thought, "I'll follow him. Everyone's going to follow him." I think I should have been Ireland captain, but I didn't want to put that on Brian. I didn't want it to seem like an ego trip. I'll only go back if I'm the captain. But I should have brought it up in the conversation. I think Kenny enjoyed the media side of the role. We'd come in at the end of a game, and Kenny would come in after us because he'd been talking to the TV people. That would piss me off a bit. "Don't forget your place. It's about the team." My first game back was a friendly against Romania at Lansdowne Road. We won 1-0. Matty Holland scored. It was good to be back. Really, really emotional. I'd always loved the bus journey to the games. Kids waving flags. I used to love all that. The police sirens and the rebel songs on the bus. I enjoyed them. It was tradition. We were on the bus going to Lansdowne, and we got stuck in a bit of traffic, not far from the hotel. I was sitting by the window, and there was a young kid outside looking up, and he said, "Welcome back." It was like he'd been planted there. I said to myself, "It's good to be back." The game itself, the national anthem, all emotional stuff. I always hated the hanging around and the travelling. But the bus journey and the game, if it had just been about those two things, it would have been perfect. I was glad to be back. But the consequences of the decision were about to bite me in the arse. I made myself available to play away to Switzerland in the second qualifier in September 04, although I'd fractured my ribs. I'd done that a few weeks before a Champions League qualifier against Dynamo Bucharest. I played in our next Premiership game against Norwich, but my ribs were at me. I'd been ruled out for 4 or 5 weeks, but after 2 or 3, I felt better. The club doctor said it all looked fine, but I hadn't played for United. So I rang Alex Ferguson and told him I thought it'd be all right to play against Switzerland. He went fucking mad. "You're not fit enough to play for us." But I went and played against Switzerland, We drew 1-1. That was the second of the qualifiers. The first had been against Cyprus at Lansdowne. We won 3-0, but I'd missed it because of my fractured ribs. I didn't want to risk it in a game we'd probably win, and I was placating United a bit too by not playing in the less important game. We drew 0-0 with France in Paris. It wasn't the old French team. A lot of the men who had won the World Cup in 98 had retired. We should have won that game in Paris. We were unlucky. We were 1-0 up against Israel, away, and they equalised in time added on. In the return game, in Lansdowne, we were 2-0 up, and ended up drawing 2-2. I know, you make your own luck, but you need a few breaks, and Brian Kerr didn't get any. We played the Faroes a couple of weeks after United had played Arsenal in the FA Cup final. I got injured in the first few minutes of that final and ended up with a torn groin. I picked up a silly yellow card in the Faroes game. I think it was for arguing. I shouldn't have been playing because I was injured. But I was suspended for the next game, at home to Israel. I ended up watching that one in the stand. I'm not a gambler, but I had a bet on that Ian Hart would score the first goal. And he did. It was 20 quid, I think, and I got back a couple of hundred. That was the game we drew 2-2. I like to think that if I'd been playing, we'd have won. I could have had that impact on the game. We'd drawn with France and Paris, but by the time they came to Dublin, a lot of their best players had come out of retirement. I spoke to Mikhail Sylvester about it before the game. I can't believe they're all coming back. Mikhail said to me, I think there were financial incentives. They beat us 1-0. We didn't qualify. But I liked working under Brian. He should have been given more time. Another crack at qualifying for the Euros. We were so close. The two draws against Israel killed us. I played in 6 of the 10 qualifiers. I was injured or suspended for the other 4. I'd enjoyed being back. Although not qualifying was disappointing. And I knew there wouldn't be another campaign for me. At the start of the new year, we were still doing okay. We beat Liverpool and Villa and drew with Spurs, and we were still third when we went to Arsenal. I didn't see it as a big deal at the time. It was just a bit of argy-bargy. The circumstances, the rivalry, gave it significance, and the cameras in the tunnel. That's standard now, but I think it was quite new at the time. I was told later that the fans outside were seeing what was happening on the big screens. I didn't know that, but it was all part of the build-up and the story. But really, what's mad about the whole tunnel episode is that it had nothing to do with me. Gary Neville had come to see me just after the warm-up. It was an evening kick-off. We'd just come back into the dressing room. Gary told me that some of the Arsenal players had said something to him in the tunnel, and they weren't going to take any nonsense. They'd be waiting for him. They said there'd be none of the carry-on that had gone on in the game at Old Trafford earlier in the season. There'd been a lot of kicking and argy-bargy during that game and afterwards. Phil had played instead of me that day, and he'd been running around like a kamikaze pilot, running into everybody. I think Gary was now suffering the consequences of Phil's actions. But I didn't pay much attention to what Gary said. Whatever, Gary. I was getting into the zone myself. I was concentrating on my job, getting ready to go out onto the pitch. I wasn't one for shouting and roaring in the dressing room. I'd be geeing myself up in a calm way. The last thing I wanted was Gary in my ear hole going, they've been shouting at me in the tunnel. My attitude was, fucking deal with it, you're not 11. But he'd planted a seed in my head, warning me. I was always one of the first out of the tunnel. As captain, I'd be leading the team out. The Highbury tunnel was a strange one, like a little alleyway, very tight. It was hard to avoid contact with people, even if you were trying to. There was always a lot of tension there, and night matches always created more tension anyway. I'd forgotten my captain's armband, simple as that, so I turned to go back to the dressing room. Go down, lads, I'll be with you in a minute. I forgot my armband. And I went back, past our own players. Albert, the kit man, had the armband, and he was putting it on me. All the best, Roy. As I walked to the front, I heard something going on at the top of the tunnel. All I could see was a few fingers pointing at Gary. I lost it. 5 seconds earlier, I'd been perfectly calm, in the zone, ready for the match. But because of what Gary had said to me, I just went, "The fuckers. They are waiting for him." I thought they might have booted him out on the pitch. But in the tunnel, I just thought, "The fuckers." They were trying to bully him. They were a big team, and in the tunnel, they were even bigger. So I said to myself, "All right, let's go." I went down there. I'd lost it. But I wasn't zoning out. I wasn't forgetting about the game. I said, "We'll see you out there." I just thought they were bullying Gary. I don't think it was intimidation. It was bullying. There's a difference. If Patrick Vieira had come up to me and said, "I'm going to have you," that would have been intimidation. It would have been a clash between equal personalities. But Gary was quiet. I think they were going for one of the weaker players in the team. By weak, I don't mean it as it's usually understood. Gary was an established international. He'd 60 or 70 caps. He'd played in World Cups. He'd won the Champions League and league titles. But his personality was wrong for this. If they'd been having a go at Nicky Budd or Wes Brown, I wouldn't have said anything. I'd have walked past them, probably whistling. In football, intimidation is legitimate, but bullying isn't. I never went looking for a fullback who'd never done anything to me. I'd look for people who were in my position or were physically important for their team. I'd always thought, they can give it back to me. I never went for a tricky winger or a small fullback. "I'll see you out there." I meant it. I loved the game of football. We'd sorted out on the pitch, no hiding places. I'd read something in the match programme about the charity work Patrick supported in Senegal, where he'd been born. He'd mentioned how much he loved going back to Senegal. I said, "If you love Senegal so much, why don't you fucking play for them?" I think he said something smart to me about Ireland in the World Cup. It was grown men bitching. The referee, Graham Paul, was good. "Just leave it. Just leave it. I fucking am. Just let us out." What was important? It didn't interfere with my performance that night, and I don't think it had an impact on the game. Although it might have thrown them more than us. We went out and played like Brazil. We won the game 4-2. But the tunnel incident was all part of the TV drama. It became entertainment. Although I wasn't aware of the cameras. I was there to do a job. Win the game, get in and get out. But it was a bit like the building up to a boxing match. The weigh-in, the press conferences. When people forget that there'll actually be a fight. But I still feel that I was defending one of my teammates. I know what's right and what's wrong, and their behaviour that night was wrong. If it had come to an actual fight, Patrick could probably have killed me. But it was unacceptable. I think the football might lack that energy now, a bit. That tension. It was great. But years later, people bring up the tunnel and they don't remember the match that came after it. After the game, we'd moved up to second, behind Chelsea. I scored in our next game, a win against Birmingham. It was my 50th league goal. Scoring a goal. The best feeling ever. The jubilation. It was nice to remember where the back of the net was. We beat City and Portsmouth. We were still second. We'd had to qualify for the Champions League group stages because we'd finished third in the Premiership the season before. We got past Dynamo Bucharest when I fractured my ribs. We were drawn with Sparta Prague, Fenerbahce and Lyon. I didn't play in either of the Fenerbahce games. This probably marked the start of my accepting that I wouldn't be playing in every game. I was part of the squad rotation, and it took a bit of getting used to. I was fine about missing certain games, but not the big ones. We ended up second in the group, behind Lyon, although we'd drawn with them away and had beaten them at home. But Fenerbahce beat us 3-0 in the last game, so we finished 2 points behind Lyon and drew Milan in the next round. They beat us twice, 1-0. In the home leg, Roy Carroll couldn't hold on to a shot. It wasn't a bad mistake, but Hernan Crespo got to it. Like all good strikers, he was sniffing out the chance. He scored again in the second leg. Milan were a top team then. There was no shame in going out to a top team that had Nesta, Maldini, Pirlo and Kaká in it. We weren't quite there yet. We'd slipped behind. Just a bit. The panic button would have been pressed if Fenerbahce had knocked us out. But not Milan. Bill Bezic made the point. Sport is all about disappointment. It's about dealing with the disappointments. It's not the highs. There are so few of them. It's the defeats. The injuries. Great careers carry massive disappointments. It's how you cope with them. You have to look forward. Home in on the positives. Take the positive out of every negative. Look at the next game. But it's difficult. It was one of my biggest weaknesses. Dealing with the disappointment and the self-loathing that comes with it. I didn't get over it quickly. I couldn't. I'm not sure the greatest sports psychologist in the world working with me 24 hours a day would have had much impact. But I am open-minded about sports psychology. Bill worked at Sunderland when I was manager there. But it was always optional. I think that's very important. Whether it's yoga or diet, it shouldn't be like school. The message at United was always that Bill was there if we wanted him. I would speak to Bill about sending offs and the rage, and he'd say, your first target is to stay on the pitch for 90 minutes. I appreciated that. It was common sense. It was one of the best pieces of advice I've been given. I'd been advised before to count to 10. That was never going to work for me. Just a second, I'm angry. 1, 2. So Bill's advice was good, very practical. And towards the end of my career, he nudged me towards ideas that were helpful. I watched the 2005 Champions League final in Dubai at about 2 o'clock in the morning. It was the mad game, AC Milan against Liverpool. I never had a hatred for Liverpool, although I wasn't exactly jumping up and down on the balcony when they won. I remember thinking, Milan, you fucking idiots, when they threw it away. We had a dip in form in the league. 2 draws, 2 losses, 2 wins. If you know you're not going to win the league, you lose your edge a little bit. It went back to the first game of the season when Chelsea beat us. They went from strength to strength and we were always just behind them. We finished 3rd, behind Arsenal. Chelsea had won a record number of points and were already the champions when they came to Old Trafford. We had to applaud them onto the pitch. I didn't like that. I'm not a fan of that ritual, even when other teams had to applaud us. The applause is insincere. You don't mean it. I was cursing them under my breath. And I'd like to think my teammates were doing the same. Bastards. Cunts. I wouldn't have thought any less of the Chelsea lads if they hadn't applauded us, if the situation had been reversed. We beat Southampton 2-1 at St Mary's in the last game of the season. They were relegated after that result, and West Brom stayed up. Brian Robson, my old captain, was managing West Brom. I didn't play. I was on the bench. I got into a bit of hassle after the game. When a game is over, players who were on the bench do some running and stretches after the lads who played have gone down to the dressing room. We were doing strides and stretching out on the pitch. There was a bit of tension. A few Southampton fans hanging around. I think they shouted, "The Irish fucker." Something like that. I turned and said something like, "Well, you're going down anyway." There were only a few people there, but they started kicking up a fuss. It seemed it was all right for them to abuse me, but I wasn't allowed to say anything back. A few security lads came over and asked us to get off the pitch. They ushered us off. It meant that we wouldn't be able to do our running. Some of the players were pleased with that. But I didn't give Southampton's relegation a thought. Although I'd experienced it myself as a young player with Forest, it was dog-eat-dog. The Glazers bought Man United around this time. There was a lot of hostility towards them from fans. But from the players' point of view, I don't think it bothered us too much. I had a few shares in the club as part of my contract. So the Glazers coming in was worth a few bob to me. We played Arsenal in the FA Cup final. We hammered them that day. Rooney and Ronaldo were outstanding. We should have won. But Arsenal hung in there. It's a great trait to have. I admired them for it. We had so many chances. I had a shot blocked by Patrick Vieira near the end of the second half. It was still 0-0 after extra time. I scored my penalty. But Paul Scholes missed his. Vieira took their last penalty. He scored. But that was Patrick's last game for Arsenal. He went to Juventus during the summer. I got a really bad knock in my private parts in the first few minutes of the game. I carried on, but I got a scan about 2 weeks later, after I played for Ireland in the Faroe Islands. I had a torn groin. I'd never had an injury like it before. They slipped into a tackle, and Patrick Lee literally kneed me right in there. I was cut. It was bad enough we'd lost the cup final, but I was in agony as well. I couldn't even sit down at the do that night. I had to go to bed at about 10 o'clock. Aside from that, I was quite calm after the match. I remember thinking, we played well, we were brilliant. It was that Arsenal thing. We battered them, but they beat us on penalties. I understood sport. You could play well and still lose. You have to look at the man in the mirror. But there was no shame in losing once you'd done your best. Garth Crooks was looking for an interview with me for the BBC as losing captain. I said, not today. But I should have done it. Ronaldo and Rooney had been the two best players on the pitch. I should have said, watch those boys go. I'd rather be in our position than Arsenal's, even though they'd just won the cup. They were hanging in there that day. It was another 9 years before they won the cup again. But I wouldn't begrudge them it. I still have that admiration for Arsenal and Wenger. I think the manager could have been a bit braver. He could have put Tim Howard on for Roy Carroll. We only used two of our substitutions. If he'd just done something a bit mad, changed the goalkeepers, they might have thought, fucking hell, he must be good at saving penalties. Mind games. I'm not saying Tim would have been better than Roy, and I don't think a goalkeeper had ever been substituted in that way, although I've heard that other managers had thought about doing it if the circumstances were right. Martin O'Neill told me that he was on the verge of doing it in a playoff when he was managing Leicester, but they scored in the last few minutes of extra time, so he didn't have to. And then, of course, Van Gaal made the decision to put on Tim Krul for the penalty shootout when Holland played Costa Rica in the World Cup quarter-final. But I think it crossed the manager's mind. I remember seeing Tim Howard getting warmed up and thinking afterwards that it would have been worth the gamble. It's all hindsight. The signs were good for us. I should have said it at the time publicly, but it's hard for a player to look at things in the long term. You've just played 120 minutes and lost. But if you looked at both teams that day and wondered which of them was going to go on and win trophies, it was United. 4. I'm walking up the stairs. We're all walking up in our training kit, like a load of kids being called to the headmaster. I'm walking up and I'm thinking, here goes. The first real murmur that something was wrong came when I went back to pre-season training in July 2005. It seems so trivial now, but it was a pretty big argument, because of a villa in Portugal. We'd had a week's pre-season training at a place called Vale de Loba in the Algarve. We brought the families with us. We'd never done it before, brought the families. It was almost unheard of. I'd already been there in the Algarve for a week with my family, very close to the training camp. The rest of the team were flying in on Sunday, and training would start on Monday. So we drove down there on Saturday to move into our villa. A lady there, she was a resort manager, I think, took me up to the townhouse that my family was to stay in. I looked around the place and I told her, I've got 5 kids. This is too small. There were 3 bedrooms, and there was a plunge pool, which I thought was dangerous. We had 5 children, and the oldest was 10. I just wasn't comfortable with it. She told me that no one had mentioned to her that I had 5 kids. She understood what I meant, I think. She told me it hadn't been designed for families. She even pointed out the glass tables, the sharp corners. They probably have to go through that routine for insurance reasons. The place just wasn't suitable. My wife was very placid, and even she was saying, "We can't stay here, it's not designed for kids." The woman brought me to look at